Welcome to another episode of the Deborah Health Report, where we dive into current health and medical topics to keep the Delaware Valley informed and updated. Last month, we focused on aortic valve disease, which causes the valve to the main pumping chamber of the heart to malfunction, and what happens to the body when it does. This month, we examine AFib, the most common of arrhythmias, and how it is diagnosed, staged, and treated, including an assessment of COVID's impact and new technologies in electrophysiology. Here's Rasa Kay.
Hi, I'm Rasa Kay. So many romantic terms in the English language about cardiac symptoms. Something pulls at your heartstrings, or someone is hard-hearted or soft-hearted. But really, truly, when your heart skips a beat, it could be an arrhythmia, and you might need to see a cardiologist. This month, we're talking about the most common arrhythmia, atrial fibrillation, or AFib, with Deborah cardiac electrophysiologist, Dr. Rafael Corbiziero.
Arrhythmia is when the heart does not beat normally. It's different than palpitations, which are a common complaint, because palpitations can be a normal rhythm that you feel, like if your heart's going fast because you're excited, versus an abnormal rhythm, meaning that it's not the normal sequence of electrical events in the heart.
Types of arrhythmias?
We classify them. Common arrhythmias are skipped beats. So you can have atrial premature contractions, which are skip beats from the top part of the heart, or premature ventricular contractions, PVCs, which are skip beats from the bottom part of the heart. So those are single skip beats that can sometimes cause skipping and flip-flopping in the chest. And then there are actually abnormal circuits that arise. In young people, circuits can be what's called a supraventricular tachycardia, where a circuit forms and the heart races. Usually that's a regular, fast heartbeat. The most common arrhythmia is atrial fibrillation, and that's when the top part becomes electrical chaos and the heart is very irregular. And that's an issue that needs attention, because not only does it cause symptoms for the patient, but it may cause sequelae, the biggest of which is stroke.
The sensations of these types of arrhythmias, it's not like, you know, your heart's skipping a beat because you see someone across that crowded room. There are specific ways you might feel,
correct,
depending on the arrhythmia.
Yes. And it's very subjective. I've had patients who came in with an abnormal heart rhythm and a heart rate of 200 who didn't know anything was wrong. And I've had patients who can tell me every single skip beat they have, what time and what it did to them. So it's very subjective.
What do these skip beats do to a patient, besides just your chest feeling funny?
It depends on the patient. But again, what it can lead to if you have flip-flopping in the chest or irregular rhythm is sometimes when the heart doesn't work, you may not function as well. So you may become very tired, short of breath. You may have chest discomfort with it. You may even lead to you feeling like you're going to pass out, or you do pass out.
And that would arise like out of nowhere.
True. It's hard to predict rhythm disturbances when they're going to occur. Some people have known triggers, but to be honest, a lot of the patients spend a lot of time trying to control things that are really not under their control.
Triggers. What might a trigger be?
The most common trigger is stress. So we see a lot of arrhythmias induced with any type of stress. It can be physical or emotional. There are obviously certain events that occur that can lead to rhythms. You know, the most serious of which is if you have a heart attack, there are rhythm disturbances associated with that that can be life-threatening. And obviously a heart attack, life-threatening arrhythmia, this is something that needs to be dealt with immediately. Other triggers, there are some foods that are triggers. Everybody likes to say caffeine is a trigger, but the data on that is kind of plus minus. So I tell people, you know, if caffeine does bother you, then it's your trigger, but it may not bother you. So if you need a cup of coffee, try it.
Now, when you say stress, there's good stress too. Like you're planning your wedding. Everything is, it's a crazy, happy time. Is that the kind of stress that could trigger it?
Correct. Yes. Anything that that increases adrenaline, if you have what we call the substrate, in other words, if you're prone to having a rhythm disturbance, then the trigger might bring it out. And that's kind of the world that we live in electrophysiology. You have what's called the substrate. In other words, you're prone towards certain problems. And then there's a trigger. And those things can sort of be in play. You might have a little bit of substrate, but if the trigger is big enough, you see the problem. Whereas you have a really strong substrate, the littlest trigger might bring it out.
Is pain associated with rhythm problems?
It can be. Honestly, that's sort of on the other end of rhythm problems. So pain usually will induce the vagus nerve to be stimulated and releases a chemical that can affect the heart rhythm. Usually that's the slow side of things. That may make the heart rate go very slow. You may actually not be able to conduct your beats normally. I've had issues where I go to the emergency room because they've called me because the patient needs a pacemaker because they're going so slow. And really what they need is their gallbladder taken out because they're having such gallbladder pain.
Huh. In terms of the most serious of the heart rhythm problems, AFib is top of the list, correct?
No.
So how do we rank the universe of arrhythmias?
Yes.
Okay.
So the number one cause of death in this country is sudden cardiac arrest. That is a rhythm problem from the bottom part of the heart called ventricular fibrillation. That is something that needs to be addressed. You need to have a risk evaluation for that, and you need to protect people who are at high risk. The best protection we have for that is not medicine. It's a device called a defibrillator. That is the number one leading cause of death in this country. It alone almost outweighs all cancers combined. Okay, so in our population in cardiology, it affects 50 to 60% of patients, especially the high-risk ones that are post-heart attack, post-myocardial infarction.
And then coming down from that?
Ventricular fibrillation and causes of death, obviously, to me, number one. After that, atrial fibrillation is probably the one that causes the most sequelae consequences for patients. Not as life-threatening, but certainly can affect patients in many, many ways that are sometimes overlooked by a lot of people in medicine.
So who's at risk for rhythm issues?
Typically, you know, we have a saying that usually abnormal rhythms come from abnormal hearts. That's clearly the case in ventricular fibrillation. So the common scenario in this country is you have heart attack, your heart has scar, you are at risk for rhythm problems there. We base that risk on the amount of scar or how the heart functions. What I mean by that is a normal heartbeat, when it squeezes, we like to see half of what's in there get pumped out. So that fraction, half, is 50%. So with the data that we've accumulated over the last, 30 years, when that fraction is 35% or low, we think that's when the increased risk of ventricular fibrillation occurs, and that's the people who we protect ahead of time. Because with ventricular fibrillation, you want to give the protection before anything happens. Because sudden cardiac arrest, by definition, is sudden. And if you don't get to the patient within 5 to 10 minutes, the patient's not going to do well. So if we were putting in defibrillators for patients who already had an event, we wouldn't be helping a lot of patients because very few survive.
So you talk about abnormal rhythms, abnormal heart. What causes that? How do we control or prevent getting to that point?
So that's like a common sense question, right? Do we know how to eat, and we know we should have exercise? Yes, these are the common things. So to prevent heart disease, to prevent atrial fibrillation, we know that if you have high blood pressure, keep it under control. If you have diabetes, keep your sugars under control. Control your A1C. If you're not active, you should be active. These are common sense things that we all know.
Because when your heart becomes unhealthy, it becomes an abnormal heart, prone to
rhythm problems.
Okay. I just want to make sure that we're not making it sound like, oh, you're just that unlucky.
Yeah. For the most part, abnormal hearts lead to abnormal rhythms. Atrial fibrillation can occur all by itself. You can work it up, and there may not be any other risk factors. And unfortunately, it may be one of those rhythms that can occur when you're otherwise healthy. You've done everything right, except you've grown older, and you're at risk for it.
Just recently, we had that research out of the Pittsburgh Medical Center hospital system. And over almost 10 years, they pulled all their patient data for people who had sought care for AFib. So it was around 67,000, not a bad study. And around 26% of those patients were younger than 65. Now, those researchers were really surprised at that. That was a very high number. They were expecting something like 2% under 65. Who's our demographic for AFib?
We start to see AFib after the age of 40, typically. You can see it in younger patients if they have other rhythm disturbances. They can occur in structurally normal hearts. The common risk factors are high blood pressure, diabetes, thyroid disease needs to be worked out. And then one of the biggest ones that is ignored a lot is obstructive sleep apnea. Many people have that, and that may be one of the triggers for AFib. I think that we're seeing more things because in this day and age, we're able to monitor much more things. You know, in years gone by, we used to do what's called a Holter monitor for 24 hours. We would look for 24 hours. I don't know how that would help us predict what happens for the rest of the year. But now we have devices that can record things 24/7, whether we implant them as a little chip called a loop recorder, or the patients have the Apple Watch, they have the cardio device where they check themselves. So I think there's much more information available. And then all of that has to be risk stratified, right? So someone, just because someone who's 45 years old has AFib, they have to be risk stratified before we would go and treat them. So if you're 45 years old with no risk factors, we just watch the AFib, right? Because most of that was seen in the study was just what's called paroxysms of AFib. It would come and go, and the patient was otherwise okay. If the AFib were to stay and become permanent, then that would have to be addressed.
What's the difference in terms of how you be feeling between the paroxysms, the coming and going of it, and it becoming permanent?
Again, it's very subjective for the patients. Some of them don't feel it at all. Some of them feel every skip beat. So that remains subjective. So patients who come in and they tell me, you know, I used to play two sets of tennis. Now I'm playing doubles one set. I figure I'm just getting old. They're in AFib. Or I have patients who have, you know, my memory's getting a little shot, you know, I'm just getting older, or I can't. And really, it's just the AFib. So AFib can be that subtle, right? It can affect your memory, your mentation, your digestion, your exercise capacity, and people may not attribute it to the AFib. So I've had many patients come in with AFib. We get normal rhythm back, and they're back to playing two sets of tennis.
When you say sleep apnea, are you talking about uncontrolled sleep apnea? If you're doing your CPAP or whatever your therapy to manage your sleep apnea, does that take care of the AFib?
Untreated sleep apnea obviously is a big trigger.
So it's untreated?
Yeah. Treated, it should help decrease the AFib.
Are we seeing more AFib because we have better monitoring?
I believe so.
COVID have any impact?
Yes.
Explain.
COVID, like any pneumonia, will be a trigger for arrhythmias, especially atrial fibrillation. So if someone otherwise healthy with no risk factors, but had especially the first round of COVID, we would see atrial fibrillation with that. Now, typically, if someone comes in with a pneumonia, COVID or otherwise, and they have AFib, we will attribute it to the pneumonia, treat the pneumonia, and just monitor the patient, not really go down the road of treating the AFib. Because if there's an obvious trigger to it, we'll treat the trigger. Right. So that happens a lot in our field. People come in with pneumonia, people come in with overactive thyroids, and they have AFib. That's a secondary issue. Just like when we see commonly after open heart surgery, we see atrial fibrillation. If they didn't have it before, then we're going to say that was because of the surgery, and we're not going to go down the road of treating the atrial fibrillation. We're going to say that that was secondary to the initiating event.
So is that sort of an assumption that in those cases, the AFib will resolve?
Yes, that's what we would think, if they don't have a history of AFib. But we would still watch them, right? I mean, we did a study once with these new, you know, loop recorders. Loop recorders are placed underneath the chest. They record everything 24/7. So we know a lot about AFib. We give that when we're concerned about the patient. Most common use in this country is for a cryptogenic stroke. So an unexplained stroke, about 40% of the time, that may be related to atrial fibrillation, so we place these devices. In one study, we placed a device in someone with no history of AFib, just risk factors, high blood pressure, diabetes, age, and we were able to diagnose AFib before the patient even knew about it.
How does AFib cause a stroke?
The way that the heart beats is in sequence. Top part of the heart contracts, squeezes in uniform, pushes blood down through the valves to the bottom, and then the bottom beats out to the body. In atrial fibrillation, the top part no longer squeezes normally, becomes very chaotic. So it's just really quivering. Now, that's okay from a plumbing standpoint because the work of the heart is really done on the bottom. The ventricle does most of the work. But when the top part does not squeeze normally, not all the blood that's up there gets pushed down. So blood will hang out, stagnate, and form a clot. There is a structure in the top part of the heart called an appendage, which is made to sort of collect stagnated blood, and that's where the clots form. And then if it breaks off and beats out to the body, depending upon where it goes, will cause a problem, worst of which being the brain and stroke.
So how do you categorize AFib? The types, and I guess, are there severity stages?
The issue is when it starts, usually it's paroxysms, comes and goes. Then it can become permanent. The thing with atrial fibrillation, if we're going to treat it properly, we have to get to the patient as soon as possible. So when someone is first diagnosed with AFib, be paroxysmal, as many as over 20% of them become permanent within 1 year. So I try to tell my colleagues, you know, when you first diagnose it, you really should think about aggressively treating the problem within the first year. Because if you let it go, which happens far too often in our field, that they just let people live with AFib and then they have to deal with the sequelae.
So how do we diagnose?
Usually the patient will come in and we'll catch it with monitoring. Unfortunately, a lot of times, you know, we'll see patients for the first time. They don't tell you about the AFib, someone else does. Most common example, you go for your routine scope and they cancel your procedure because you're in atrial fibrillation. It's like, I am, and that's when the workup starts. But you have to be very cognizant of the people who are at risk.
All right, so when you say a scope, like a colonoscopy or an endoscopy
Yeah, if someone goes for a procedure and they cancel the procedure because the EKG is abnormal. So that happens quite a bit.
Do people bring their Apple Watches in and say, my watch is going haywire?
Yes, yes. But I like the Apple Watch much better than the Fitbit. The Fitbit used to drive me crazy.
Really? Because too sensitive?
Because people said my heart rate was 300. No, your heart rate wasn't 300. Trust me.
Yeah, okay. In general, self-monitoring is a good thing.
I think so. I think more information is always better.
Okay, so you find it on an EKG randomly. Mm-hmm. But if somebody has been having symptoms, you know, the lightheadedness, dizziness, sometimes even nausea, I mean, whatever that would send them to have this looked at, what are the next steps in terms of testing?
Usually when someone has a rhythm disturbance, right, we're going to do an initial cardiac workup. So we're probably going to do what's called an echocardiogram, an ultrasound, to see what the structure of the heart is, structure of the valves. Probably going to do some evaluation for ischemia, any blockages, to see if that may be a contributing factor, and then monitoring. So we want to know what type of patient we have. If the workup is negative, in other words, heart is structurally normal, there's no valve issues, we don't think there's any blockages, you know, we think the blood flow to the heart is normal, then we'll go down the road of treatment for the AFib.
That's Deborah Cardiac Electrophysiologist, Dr. Rafael Corbiziero. Next month, we get into how these electricians of the heart repair the circuitry and restore a normal rhythm. As always, the podcast drops the first Wednesday of the month. I'm Rasa Kay.
You can always listen to all of the informative Deborah Doctor interviews at DeborahHealthReport.com. Schedule an appointment at DemandDeborah.org.